2. The Shadow. Ged had thought that as the prentice of a great mage, he would enter at once into the mystery and mastery of power. He would understand the language of the beasts, and the speech of the leaves of the forest, he thought, and sway the winds with his word, and learn to change himself into any shape he wished. Maybe he and his master would run together as stags, or fly to Re Albi over the mountain on the wings of eagles. But it was not so at all. They wandered, first down into the vale, and then gradually south and westward around the mountain, given lodging in little villages or spending the night out in the wilderness, like poor journeymen sorcerers, or tinkers, or beggars. They entered no mysterious domain. Nothing happened. The mage's oaken staff that Ged had watched at first with eager dread was nothing but a stout staff to walk with. 3 days went by, and 4 days went by, and still Ogion had not spoken a single charm in Ged's hearing, and had not taught him a single name, or rune, or spell. Though a very silent man, he was so mild and calm that Ged soon lost his awe of him, and in a day or two he was more than bold enough to ask his master, "When will my apprenticeship begin, sir?" "It has begun," said Ogion. There was a silence, as if Ged was keeping back something he had to say. Then he said it. "But I haven't learned anything yet." "Because you haven't found out what I'm teaching," replied the mage, going on at his steady, long-legged pace along their road, which was the high pass between Ovirk and Wyss. He was a dark man, like most Gauntish men, dark, copper-brown, grey-haired, lean and tough as a hound, tireless. He spoke seldom, ate little, slept less. His eyes and ears were very keen, and often there was a listening look on his face. Ged did not answer him. It is not always easy to answer a mage. "You want to work spells," Ogion said presently, striding along. "You've drawn too much water from that well. Wait. Manhood is patience. Mastery is 9 times patience. What is that herb by the path?"
Straw flower.
"And that?"
I don't know.
"Forfoil, they call it." Ogion had halted, the copper-shod foot of his staff near the little weed. So Ged looked closely at the plant, and plucked a dry seed-pod from it, and finally asked, since Ogion said nothing more, "What is its use, master?" "None that I know of." Ged kept the seed-pot a while as they went on, then tossed it away. "When you know the forfoil in all its seasons, root and leaf and flower, by sight and scent and seed, then you may learn its true name, knowing its being, which is more than its use. What, after all, is the use of you, or of myself? Is Gaunt Mountain useful? Or the open sea?" Ogion went on a half mile or so, and said at last, "To hear, one must be silent." The boy frowned. He did not like to be made to feel a fool. He kept back his resentment and impatience, and tried to be obedient, so that Ogion would consent at last to teach him something. For he hungered to learn, to gain power. It began to seem to him, though, that he could have learned more walking with any herb-gatherer or village sorcerer. And as they went round the mountain westward into the lonely forests, past Wyss, he wondered more and more what was the greatness and magic of this great mage, Ogion. For when it rained, Ogion would not even say a spell that every weather-worker knows to send the storm aside. In a land where sorcerers come thick, like Gaunt, or the Enlades, you may see a rain-cloud blundering slowly from side to side and place to place as one spell shunts it on to the next, till at last it is buffeted out over the sea, where it can rain in peace. But Ogion let the rain fall where it would. He found a thick fir tree and lay down beneath it. Ged crouched among the dripping bushes, wet and sullen, and wondered what was the good of having power if you were too wise to use it, and wished he had gone on as prentice to that old weather-worker of the Vale, where at least he would have slept dry. He did not speak any of his thoughts aloud. He said not a word. His master smiled and fell asleep in the rain. Along towards sunreturn, when the first heavy snows began to fall in the heights of Gaunt, they came to Rhea Albi, Ogion's home. It is a town on the edge of the high rocks of Overfell, and its name means Falcon's Nest. From it, one can see far below the deep harbour and the towers of the port of Gaunt, and the ships that go in and out the gate of the bay between the armed cliffs, and far to the west, across the sea, one may make out the blue hills of Aranea, easternmost of the Inward Isles. The major's house, though large and soundly built of timber, with hearth and chimney rather than a fire pit, was like the huts of Tenalder's village, all one room, with a goat shed built to one side. There was a kind of alcove in the west wall of the room, where Ged slept. Over his pallet was a window that looked out on the sea, but most often the shutters must be closed against the great winds that blew all winter from the west and north. In the dark warmth of that house, Ged spent the winter, hearing the rush of rain and wind outside, or the silence of snowfall, learning to write and read the 600 runes of Hardik. Very glad he was to learn this lore, for without it, no mere rote learning of charms and spells will give a man true mastery. The Hardik tongue of the archipelago, though it has no more magic power in it than any other tongue of man, has its roots in the old speech, that language in which things are named with their true names, and the way to the understanding of this speech starts with the runes that were written when the islands of the world first were raised up from the sea. Still, no marvels and enchantments occurred. All winter there was nothing but the heavy pages of the rune book turning, and the rain, and the snow falling. And Ogion would come in from roaming the icy forests, or from looking after his goats, and stamp the snow off his boots, and sit down in silence by the fire. And the mage's long, listening silence would fill the room, and fill Ged's mind, until sometimes it seemed he had forgotten what words sounded like. And when Ogion spoke at last, it was as if he had, just then and for the first time, invented speech. Yet the words he spoke were no great matters, but had to do only with simple things, bread, and water, and weather, and sleep. As the spring came on, quick and bright, Ogion often sent Ged forth to gather herbs on the meadows above Rhea Albi, and told him to take as long as he liked about it, giving him freedom to spend all day wandering by rain-filled streams, and through the woods, and over wet, green fields in the sun. Ged went with delight each time, and stayed out until night. But he did not entirely forget the herbs. He kept an eye out for them, while he climbed and roamed and waded and explored, and always brought some home. He came on a meadow between two streams, where the flower called white hallows grew thick. And as these blossoms are rare and prized by healers, he came back again next day. Someone else was there before him, a girl, whom he knew by sight as the daughter of the old lord of Rhea Albi. He would not have spoken to her, but she came to him and greeted him pleasantly.
I know you. You are the Sparrowhawk, our mage's adept. I wish you would tell me about sorcery.
He looked down at the white flowers that brushed against her white skirt, and at first he was shy and glum and hardly answered. But she went on talking in an open, careless, willful way that little by little set him at ease. She was a tall girl of about his own age, very sallow, almost white-skinned. Her mother, they said in the village, was from Oskil, or some such foreign land. Her hair fell long and straight like a fall of black water. Ged thought her very ugly, but he had a desire to please her, to win her admiration, that grew on him as they talked. She made him tell all the story of his tricks with the mist that had defeated the Kargish warriors, and she listened as if she wondered and admired, but she spoke no praise. And soon she was off on another tack. "Can you call the birds and beasts to you?" she asked.
"I can," said Ged.
He knew there was a falcon's nest in the cliffs above the meadow, and he summoned the bird by its name. It came, but it would not light on his wrist, being put off, no doubt, by the girl's presence. It screamed and struck the air with broad, barred wings, and rose up on the wind.
"What do you call that kind of charm that made the falcon come?"
"A spell of summoning."
"Can you call the spirits of the dead to come to you too?"
He thought she was mocking him with this question, because the falcon had not fully obeyed his summons. He would not let her mock him.
"I might if I chose," he said in a calm voice. "Is it not very difficult, very dangerous, to summon a spirit?"
"Difficult, yes. Dangerous?" He shrugged. This time he was almost certain there was admiration in her eyes.
"Can you make a love charm?"
"Oh, that is no mastery."
"True,"
says she.
"Any village witch can do it." "Can you do changing spells? Can you change your own shape as wizards do, they say?"
Again, he was not sure, quite, that she did not ask the question mockingly. And so again he replied,
"I might if I choose."
She began to beg him to transform himself into anything he wished. A hawk, a bull, a fire, a tree. He put her off with short, secretive words such as his master used, but he did not know how to refuse flatly when she coaxed him. And besides, he did not know whether he himself believed his boast or not. He left her, saying that his master, the mage, expected him at home, and he did not come back to the meadow the next day. But the day after, he came again, saying to himself that he should gather more of the flowers while they bloomed. She was there, and together they waded barefoot in the boggy grass, pulling the heavy white hallow blooms. The sun of spring shone, and she talked with him as merrily as any goat-herd lass of his own village. She asked him again about sorcery, and listened wide-eyed to all he told her, so that he fell to boasting again. Then she asked him if he would not work a changing spell. And when he put her off, she looked at him, putting back the black hair from her face, and said,
"Are you afraid to do it?"
"No, I'm not afraid." She smiled a little disdainfully and said,
"Maybe you're too young."
That he would not endure. He did not say much, but he resolved that he would prove himself to her. He told her to come again to the meadow tomorrow, if she liked, and so took leave of her, and came back to the house while his master was still out. He went straight to the shelf and took down two law books, which Ogion had never yet opened in his presence. He looked for a spell of self-transformation, but being slow to read the runes yet, and understanding little of what he read, he could not find out what he sought. These books were very ancient, Ogion having them from his own master, Haleth Farseer,
and Haleth from his master, the mage of Perigal, and so back into the times of myth. Small and strange was the writing, overwritten and interlined by many hands, and all those hands were dust now. Yet here and there Ged understood something of what he tried to read, and with the girl's questions and her mockery always in his mind, he stopped on a page that bore a spell of summoning, the spirits of the dead. As he read it, puzzling out the runes and symbols one by one, a horror came over him. His eyes were fixed, and he could not lift them till he had finished reading all the spell. Then, raising his head, he saw it was dark in the house. He had been reading without any light, in the darkness. He could not now make out the runes when he looked down at the book. Yet the horror grew in him, seeming to hold him bound to his chair. He was cold. Looking over his shoulder, he saw that something was crouching beside the closed door, a shapeless clot of shadow darker than the darkness. It seemed to reach out towards him, and to whisper, and to call to him in a whisper, but he could not understand the words. The door was flung wide. A man entered with a white light flaming about him, a great bright figure who spoke loud, fiercely and suddenly. The darkness and the whispering ceased and were dispelled. The horror went out of Ged, but still he was mortally afraid, for it was Oggy and the mage who stood there in the doorway with a brightness all about him, and the oaken staff in his hand burned with a white radiance. Saying no word, the mage came past Ged and lighted the lamp and put the books away on their shelf. Then he turned to the boy and said, "You will never work that spell but in peril of your power and your life. Was it for that spell you opened the books?"
"No, master,"
the boy murmured, and shamefully he told Ogion what he had sought and why. "You do not remember what I told you, that that girl's mother, the lord's wife, is an enchantress?" Indeed, Ogion had once said this, but Ged had not paid much attention, though he knew by now that Ogion never told him anything that he had not good reason to tell him. "The girl herself is half a witch already. It may be the mother who sent the girl to talk to you. It may be she who opened the book to the page you read. The powers she serves are not the powers I serve. I do not know her will, but I know she does not will me well. Ged, listen to me now. Have you never thought how danger must surround power as shadow does light? This sorcery is not a game we play for pleasure or for praise. Think of this. That every word, every act of our art, is said and is done either for good or for evil. Before you speak or do, you must know the price that is to pay." Driven by his shame, Ged cried,
"How am I to know these things when you teach me nothing? Since I lived with you, I have done nothing, seen nothing."
"Now you have seen something," said the mage. "By the door, in the darkness, when I came in." Ged was silent. Ogion knelt down and built the fire on the hearth and lit it, for the house was cold. Then, still kneeling, he said in his quiet voice, "Ged, my young falcon, you are not bound to me or my service. You did not come to me, but I to you. You are very young to make this choice, but I cannot make it for you. If you wish, I will send you to Roke Island, where all high arts are taught. Any craft you undertake to learn, you will learn, for your power is great, greater even than your pride, I hope. I would keep you here with me, for what I have is what you lack. but I will not keep you against your will. Now choose between Rey Albi and Roke. Ged stood dumb, his heart bewildered. He had come to love this man, Ogion, who had healed him with a touch, and who had no anger. He loved him, and had not known it until now. He looked at the oaken staff leaning in the chimney corner, remembering the radiance of it that had burned out evil from the dark, and he yearned to stay with Ogion, to go wandering through the forests with him, long and far, learning how to be silent. Yet other cravings were in him that would not be stilled, the wish for glory, the will to act. Ogion seemed a long road towards mastery, a slow bypath to follow, when he might go sailing before the sea wind straight to the inmost sea, to the Isle of the Wise, where the air was bright with enchantments and the archmage walked amidst wonders. "Master," he said, "I will go to Roke." So, a few days later, on a sunny morning of spring, Ogion strode beside him down the steep road from the Overfell, 15 miles, to the great port of Gaunt. There, at the land gate between carven dragons, the guards of the city of Gaunt, seeing the mage, knelt with bared swords and welcomed him. They knew him, and did him honour by the prince's order and their own will. For 10 years ago, Ogion had saved the city from earthquake that would have shaken the towers of the rich down to the ground and closed the channel of the armed cliffs with avalanche. He had spoken to the mountain of Gaunt, calming it, and had stilled the trembling precipices of the Overfell as one soothes a frightened beast. Ged had heard some talk of this, and now, wondering to see the armed guardsman kneel to his quiet master, he remembered it. He glanced up almost in fear at this man who had stopped an earthquake. But Ogion's face was quiet, as always. They went down to the quays, where the harbour master came hastening to welcome Ogion, and asked what service he might do. The mage told him, and at once he named a ship bound for the inmost sea, aboard which Ged might go as a passenger. "Or they will take him as windbringer," he said, "if he has the craft. They have no weather worker aboard." "He has some skill with mist and fog, but none with sea winds," the mage said, putting his hand lightly on Ged's shoulder. "Do not try any tricks with the sea and the winds of the sea, Sparrowhawk. You are a landsman still." "Harbour master, what is the ship's name?"
Shadow, from the Andrades, bound to Hort Town with furs and ivories. A good ship, Master Ogion."
The major's face darkened at the name of the ship, but he said, "So be it. Give this writing to the warder of the school on Roke, Sparrowhawk. Go with a fair wind. Farewell." That was all his parting. He turned away and went striding up the street away from the quays. Ged stood forlorn and watched his master go.
"Come along, lad," said the harbour master, and took him down the waterfront to the pier, where Shadow was making ready to sail.
It might seem strange that on an island 50 miles wide, in a village under cliffs that stare out forever on the sea, a child may grow to manhood, never having stepped in a boat or dipped his finger in salt water. But so it is. Farmer, goat-herd, cattle-herd, hunter, or artisan, the landsman looks at the ocean as at a salt, unsteady realm that has nothing to do with him at all. The village, 2 days' walk from his village, is a foreign land, and the island, a day's sail from his island, is a mere rumour, misty hills seen across the water, not solid ground like that he walks on. So to Ged, who had never been down from the heights of the mountain, the port of Gaunt was an awesome and marvellous place. Great houses and towers of cut stone and waterfront of piers and docks and basins and moorages. The seaport, where half a hundred boats and galleys rocked at quayside or lay hauled up and overturned for repairs, or stood at anchor in the roadstead with furled sails and closed oar ports, the sailors shouting in strange dialects, and the longshoremen running heavy laden amongst barrels and boxes and coils of rope and stacks of oars, the bearded merchants in furred robes conversing quietly as they picked their way along the slimy stones above the water, the fishermen unloading their catch, coopers pounding and shipmakers hammering and clam sellers singing and shipmasters bellowing, and beyond all, the silent, shining bay. With eyes and ears and mind bewildered, he followed the harbour-master to the broad dock where Shadow was tied up, and the harbour-master brought him to the master of the ship. With few words spoken, the ship's master agreed to take Ged as passenger to Roke, since it was a mage that asked it, and the harbour-master left the boy with him. The master of the Shadow was a big man, and fat, in a red cloak trimmed with Pulawi fur, such as Andradian merchants wear. He never looked at Ged, but asked him in a mighty voice, "Can you work weather, boy?"
"I can."
"Can you bring the wind?" He had to say he could not. And with that, the master told him to find a place out of the way and stay in it. The oarsmen were coming aboard now, for the ship was to go out into the roadstead before night fell, and sail with the ebb tide near dawn. There was no place out of the way, but Ged climbed up as well as he could onto the bundled, lashed and hide-covered cargo in the stern of the ship, and clinging there, watched all that passed. The oarsmen came leaping aboard, sturdy men with great arms, while longshoremen rolled water barrels thundering out the dock and stowed them under the rowers' benches. The well-built ship rode low with her burden, yet danced a little on the lapping shore waves, ready to be gone. Then the steersman took his place at the right of the sternpost, looking forward to the ship's master, who stood on a plank let in at the jointure of the keel with the stern, which was carved as the old serpent of Andrad. The master roared his orders hugely, and Shadow was untied and towed clear of the docks by two labouring rowboats. Then the master's roar was, "Open ports!" And the great oars shot rattling out, 15 to a side. The rowers bent their strong backs, while a lad up beside the master beat the stroke on a drum. Easy as a gull, oared by her wings, the ship went now, and the noise and hurly-burly of the city fell away suddenly behind it. They came out into the silence of the waters of the bay, and over them rose the high peak of the mountain, seeming to hang above the sea. In a shallow creek in the lee of the southern armed cliff, the anchor was thrown over, and there they rode the night. Of the 70 crewmen of the ship, some were like Ged, very young in years, though all had made their passage into manhood. These lads called him over to share their food and drink with them, and were friendly, though rough and full of jokes and jibes. They called him Goatherd, of course, because he was gauntish, but they did not go further than that. He was as tall and strong as the 15-year-olds, and quick to return either a good word or a jeer. So he made his way among them, and even that first night began to live as one of them and learn their work. This suited the ship's officers, for there was no room aboard for idle passengers. There was little enough room for the crew, and no comfort at all. In an undecked galley crowded with men and gear and cargo. But what was comfort to Ged? He lay that night among corded rolls of pelts from the Northern Isles and watched the stars of spring above the harbour waters and the little yellow lights of the city astern, and he slept and waked again, full of delight. Before dawn, the tide turned. They raised anchor and rowed softly out between the armed cliffs. As sunrise reddened the mountain of Gaunt behind them, they raised the high sail and ran southwestward over the Gauntish sea. Between Barnisk and Torhaven they sailed with a light wind, and on the second day came in sight of Havnor, the great island, heart and hearth of the archipelago. For 3 days they were in sight of the green hills of Havnor, as they worked along its eastern coast, but they did not come ashore. Not for many years did Ged set foot on that land, or see the white towers of Havnor Great Port at the centre of the world. They lay over one night at Kembermouth, the northern port of Way Island, and the next at a little town on the entrance of Felkway Bay, and the next day passed the northern cape of O, and entered the Abavnor Straits. There they dropped sail and rowed, always with land on either side, and always within hail of other ships, great and small, merchants and traders, some bound in from the outer reaches with strange cargo after a voyage of years, and others that hopped like sparrows from isle to isle of the inmost sea. Turning southward out of the crowded straits, they left Havnor astern, and sailed between the two fair islands, Ark and Ilien, towered and terraced with cities, and then, through rain and rising wind, began to beat their way across the inmost sea to Roke Island. In the night, as the wind freshened to a gale, they took down both sail and mast, and the next day, all day, they rowed. The long ship lay steady on the waves and went gallantly, but the steersman at the long steering sweep in the stern looked into the rain that beat the sea and saw nothing but the rain. They went southwest by the pointing of the magnet, knowing how they went, but not through what waters. Ged heard men speak of the shoal waters north of Roke, and of the Borillus rocks to the east. Others argued that they might be far out of course by now in the empty waters south of Camery. Still the wind grew stronger, tearing the edges of the great waves into flying tatters of foam, and still they rowed southwest with the wind behind them. The stints of the oars were shortened, for the labour was very hard. The younger lads were set two to an oar, and Ged took his turn with the others, as he had since they left Gaunt. When they did not row, they bailed, for the seas broke heavy on the ship. So they laboured among the waves that ran like smoking mountains under the wind, while the rain beat hard and cold on their backs, and the drum thumped through the noise of the storm like a heart thumping. A man came to take Ged's place at the oar, sending him to the ship's master in the bow. Rainwater dripped from the hem of the master's cloak, but he stood stout as a wine barrel on his bit of decking and looked down at Ged. He asked, "Can you abate this wind, lad?"
"No, sir."
"Have you craft with iron?"
He meant, could Ged make the compass needle point their way to Roke, making the magnet follow not its north, but their need. That skill is a secret of the seamasters, and again Ged must say no.
"Well, then," the master bellowed through the wind and rain, "you must find some ship to take you back to Roke from Hort Town. Roke must be west of us now, and only wizardry could bring us there through this sea. We must keep south."
Ged did not like this, for he had heard the sailors talk of Hort Town, how it was a lawless place full of evil traffic, where men were often taken and sold into slavery in the South Reach. Returning to his labour at the oar, he pulled away with his companion, a sturdy Andradian lad, and heard the drumbeat, the stroke, and saw the lantern hung on the stern bob and flicker as the wind plucked it about, a tormented fleck of light in the rain-lashed dusk. He kept looking to westward, as often as he could in the heavy rhythm of the pulling of the oar, and as the ship rose on a high swell, he saw for a moment
over the dark smoking water, a light between clouds, as it might be the last gleam of sunset. But this was a clear light, not red. His oar mate had not seen it, but he called out. The steersman watched for it on each rise of the great waves, and saw it as Ged saw it again, but shouted back that it was only the setting sun. Then Ged called to one of the lads that was bailing to take his place on the bench a minute, and made his way forward again along the encumbered aisle between the benches, and catching hold of the carved prow to keep from being pitched overboard, he shouted up to the master, "Sir, that light to the west is Roke Island."
"I saw no light," the master roared.
But even as he spoke, Ged flung out his arm, pointing, and all saw the light gleam clear in the west over the heaving scud and tumult of the sea. Not for his passenger's sake, but to save his ship from the peril of the storm, the master shouted at once to the steersman to head westward toward the light. But he said to Ged,
"Boy, you speak like a seamaster. But I tell you, if you lead us wrong in this weather, I will throw you over to swim to Roke."
Now, instead of running before the storm, they must now row across the wind's way. And it was hard. Waves, striking the ship abeam, pushed her always south of their new course, and rolled her, and filled her with water, so that the bailing must be ceaseless, and the oarsmen must watch lest the ship rolling should lift their oars out of water as they pulled, and so pitch them down among the benches. It was nearly dark under the storm clouds, but now and again they made out the light to the west, enough to set course by, and so struggled on. At last the wind dropped a little, and the light grew broad before them. They rowed on, and they came, as it were, through a curtain, between one oar-stroke and the next, running out of the storm into clear air, where the light of after-sunset glowed in the sky and on the sea. Over the foam-crested waves they saw, not far off, a high, round, green hill, and beneath it a town built on a small bay, where boats lay at anchor, all in peace. The steersman, leaning on his long sweep, turned his head and called,
"Sir, is this true land or witchery?" "Keep her as she goes, you witless woodenhead. Row, you spineless slave sons. That's Thwill Bay, and the Knoll of Roke, as any fool could see. Row!"
So, to the beat of the drum, they rowed wearily into the bay. There it was still, so that they could hear the voices of people up in the town, and a bell ringing, and only far off the hiss and roaring of the storm. Clouds hung dark to north and east and south, a mile off, all about the island, but over Roke, stars were coming out, one by one, in a clear and quiet sky.